looked at the scheduling challenges that happen in these international meetings three times a year, you have a little bit of a clue of how difficult it is. And I think at this particular meeting, there are excessive number of unfortunate conflicts. So the contracted stakeholders group is meeting at the same time as this, so I don't think we have any of the counselors from that side of the, from that house. It's not just the non-contracted party house has a meeting going on right now, so we don't have any of them here, and I apologize for that. I asked those of you on this on the two working groups that are reporting not to take that as any offense of interest in these groups, but I assure you I personally will try to make up for that with lots of comments.
then Chuck, I guess it would be improper to comment on the turnout from the contracted party's house.
Well, I can tell you that one from the registries is not even here today because she had a wedding that she had to attend that was quite important. So she wouldn't have been here anyway, but I'll talk to Edmund.
Well, don't worry. We'll make sure there's plenty of things.
Okay. Has the recording started? All right. So the purpose of this session is to get a report, for the council to get a report. And it's good that it's recorded so that those who are not here will be able to listen to it. And hopefully they will. But let's go. And now, which one do we have first? Oh, it's up there. I should look, huh? Okay, Pedner. We're ready to go.
Is it possible to get that large enough for the people who are actually in this room to see it? Hey. Nice. Okay, by mutual agreement, I'm going to be presenting and Tim will officially heckle and or make other comments as necessary. By the way, it dawned on me as I was preparing this that I don't think council ever actually appointed a chair for this working group. So I'm still the acting chair. and therefore I take no responsibility for the lack of productivity that was mentioned this morning. Okay. We don't need to review too much the history since council is what is created. These slides, by the way, were prepared primarily for the public meeting we're having on Thursday. So some of the background. The only comment I'll make there is one with respect to my objection last week or at the last council meeting on the CCT report. And if you look at the last bullet, council in the charter for this group explicitly said the outcome should be consensus policy and or best practices, and explicitly limited it to that, which was the cause of my objection to the more generalized wording in the CCT report.
Well, forgive the interjection here, but did you get my email about the CCT report? And I haven't seen anything from you in that regard.
You will, sure.
Thank you.
Next slide. All right. Here we have a breakdown, sort of in summary form, of the participation, both membership, that is those who signed up for the group, and the actual active participation. And you can see part of the problem there, and perhaps one of the causes of my earlier comment today on working groups, that on a working group which was looking at trying to address new policy regarding registrars, the registrars are the largest single component in the group. And that's partly because they are participating and we haven't succeeded in getting other people to come. The competing meeting today from the non-contracted parties may be another aspect of the same problem. All right. Can we go to the next slide? The first part of what we did, the first significant part of the time we spent in the working group, was to try to identify what the current situation is. We did a survey of what ended up being the 9 largest registrars that account for something over two-thirds of the, or approximately two-thirds of all domains registered in the GTLD space. And to try to understand what the policies were and to what extent registrants had an opportunity to understand what would happen. The largest single thing that came out of that survey, as in a general sense, was that, number one, in many, many cases, what actually happens and what the registrars report as the actual practice does not match what is in the registration agreement. So the registration agreement may say the registrars may or may not do something. In some cases, it says we will not do something, but they actually do. So the reported practice is quite in line with what one expects, one would hope. The registration agreements do not necessarily say that, and therefore it's not at all clear that an innocent registrant can predict ahead of time what the situation is going to be. The other important aspect is that when we went into this whole process, there was a lot of discussion of what we called bad actors. That is, the small number of registrars or resellers who are probably causing a large number of the perceived problems. And, of course, the registrars who participate in this kind of work group are not likely those bad actors. So understanding what the people in the work group do does not necessarily map to the tail ends of the curves that are causing any perceived problems. Next one. If there's any questions, by the way, or comments, please just yell out if I'm not looking and seeing a hand. Yeah.
Hi, it's James, and I don't know if you want questions as we go along or if we want to stop each time.
I have no problem.
But going back to what you said earlier, a moment ago, Alan, regarding the registration agreement versus the real world, and I think that what we seemed to arrive at was that the registration agreement had language that was, hesitant to say worst case, but more restrictive than some of the registrars were essentially providing. It was essentially providing registrars to use discretion based on whatever the situation required. And so I just wanted to make sure it was clear that we weren't necessarily promising something in the registration agreement and then not delivering upon that promise or obligation. It was more a case of laying out the worst case scenario in the registration agreement and then having some flexibility to address that situationally.
Yeah, if I implied anything else, I certainly didn't mean to. The largest problems were where one thing was said, but then the registrar was more generous, so to speak, or in many cases the registration agreement would be either vague or I don't know what the right word is. You know, wording that is common is the registrar may or may not do something at its sole discretion. So very hard to for the registrant to have predictable results based on reading the registration agreement, if indeed people read registration agreements.
Alan, let me talk about a process issue. Obviously, we have limited time today. I'm wondering, with a small audience here, how much of the background information is needed. Now, if it's needed, let's do it. But if not, would it be more productive to focus on your specific questions that you guys ask in your report that you want feedback on?
That's exactly where we're going right now.
You're getting there quickly?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's fine.
Okay, the next step was to do a survey of the working group to try to understand where we believe we should be going. We did 2 iterations of the survey, refining words and format to some extent. The results varied between the two, which was a little bit surprising, but we'll go right now into the results of the second one. Most of these are going to be covered in a later slide. So we looked at the overarching issue, first of all, of ability to recover the domain name. Not to recover at this point, to renew the domain name post-expiration. The details of notification. What happens after expiration. And then the contractual conditions, what we were talking about a little bit, and this really comes down to clarity. Does the registrant have a chance of knowing ahead of time what's likely to happen? And lastly, some discussion of the RGP. Next slide. Okay, the first question is, The first question is, should the registrant have the ability to renew post-expiration? There was a large amount of discussion within the group on the noun we use to describe this. The terminology we started using was the terminology that is used in the RAA right now, that is a right. So a registrant should have the right to do something. There was a major objection from registrars, and we are now using the term ability. It's not clear to me what an ability, if it is ultimately enshrined in the RAA, how that differs from a right, but the semantics seem to be rather important. In the initial survey we did, we had a unanimous 100% unanimity that registrants should have the ability to recover. In the second version, we ended up with a split that everyone except the registrars, registries answering the question said they should have the ability in the RAA. The contracted parties all said it should just be a best practice.
By contracted parties, you mean the registrars?
Registrars plus the one registry that voted.
And that one registry did vote?
Yes.
I remember, okay. Now, are you going to talk about these one at a time?
I wasn't planning to talk about that particular question any more than that.
You want any feedback on that?
Certainly, if we want feedback, yes.
Okay.
The real issue is, to what extent does a best practice have any meaning in a written the registrar community, since it is not enforced at any level?
Okay. Well, I'll give you my own personal feedback.
Go for it.
Okay, because I did go through your report. Yeah, I think they should have the ability, and I'm okay with the language ability. Whether it's a right or not, that gets kind of philosophical, but I think they should have the ability. I mean, I go back to, and the problems aren't as bad now as they were when RGP was implemented and when I was directly involved in that, but yeah, I do think they should. And in terms of time frame, we can debate that, but I would think 30 days, could it be shorter than that? Maybe. I mean, the bottom line is it's a unique industry still. There are still a lot of new registrants, that this whole thing is new, and so even though we don't have as many problems as we used to have with regard to registrants not getting their notices, their email changes, they're not updating their contacts and so forth, and I don't want to totally alleviate registrants of some responsibility here, but I think some reasonable period where they can do that is good.
The current practice that we got out of the registrar survey was, I think, no one provided less than 30 days of the group that responded, of the largest ones, and the typical one, I think, in fact, was 40. There were a few that were larger and a few that were smaller than 40. So that seems to be about the norm. But as I said, a large part of that question comes down to, if one says best practice, how does one make sure that a registrar feels compelled to follow a best practice?
Yeah, and I would not. I would support making it a contractual requirement rather than a best practice.
All right. The next question that we looked at.
Sorry. It needs to be part of the spelled out as a contract obligation. One of the things I've bumped into is nonprofits, for instance, sometimes are seasonal. Sports clubs, teams that run a website during the season, and then somebody forgets about it during the winter.
I'm not sure we're going to be able to help them if they forget about it for 4 months, but nevertheless.
Yeah, this is Tim, if I could just... Yeah, I think part of the problem that registrars face, can frame it accurately, is that the registration agreement expires on a particular day. It's 1 year. And so after that, what is the obligation of registrars after that 1 year? So can we say that, can we put into policy that
You know, your registration agreement has to be extended for X number of days beyond what it's actually what is actually being agreed to, and then how do we do that? So I think there's some concern there about how that actually gets put into policy, and that's probably why registrars have been supporting the idea of a best practice. That's less complicated than a policy that extends a registration agreement beyond its actual expiration date, which is what we're really talking about doing. Besides the fact that in actual investigation, what was seen was that, as Alan pointed out, in the majority of cases, at least in the 66% of the registrations that were covered by the nine registrars that were reviewed, there is some time being given as a general practice after expiration date. So there really isn't. So where's the real problem, or what's the real harm? And that's some of the concern that registrars have raised too. So again, if we want to address the issue, it's a best practice, but to develop policy or to regulate registrars' business further without any real evidence of harm, that's going a lot farther than what the evidence sort of bears out is needed at the time. So that's, I think, in general, the concerns that the registrars have had.
Mikey?
Thanks, Alan. It's Mikey O'Connor. I think one of the underlying themes of a lot of this is not so much, at least for me, it's not the specific numbers per se, but the consistency of the experience across different registrars. I think if we can get that consistency and then get educating out there by whatever means, policy, best practice, that will go an awful long way to solving a lot of the problems that we've got.
Yeah, I don't completely disagree. I just think that we have to accept the fact that when we introduced competition into the marketplace, we introduced differentiation. And if that doesn't exist, then there really isn't any competition. So we can't take things so far in this consistency concept where we completely do away with differentiation, because then we're actually, what we've done is we do away with competition. So there's a lot of choice out there. Even when you roll up the hundreds of registrars into their little families or groups, however that's done, there's still hundreds of registrars out there, a lot of options and choices. And I think that's really key. So I would discourage taking the consistency thing too far, because that's really a big part of what makes our domain name space competitive right now.
Yeah, Chris Chaplin from the Business Constituency. I tend to support Mikey's view, and I've seen this happen with a number of clients, web design clients or hosting clients, actually, when the trigger's obviously when the website stops working, and that's when the panic sets in. So, and registrants obviously got a responsibility, but you do see a number of them that have got completely lost contact with any registration details that they ever had. And then the panic sets in, and they want to know what the procedures are now, and that consistency. You can say, well, you've got 30 days or you've got 40 days now, whichever registrar it is. I don't think people would choose a registrar based on the number of days in the redemption grace period, because it's sort of a completely unexpected and unforeseen event anyway.
Well, the redemption grace period is consistent among the registries that implement it. Now, that's not required. Maybe that's something to look at. But the redemption grace period, when it is implemented, is consistent. And that is, the certain period of days during which it can be redeemed, and then a short period at the end during which it's publicly published as being ready for deletion. So there is some consistency there. For the majority of GTLDs, the redemption grace period exists. If a name gets deleted, it's redeemable. Of course, that doesn't mean that name is resolving during that period, but it is redeemable. So there is a recoverable aspect there that is consistent across most GTLDs.
I have a couple of short comments, but we do need to go ahead, or we're not going to get to some of the more critical issues.
I'll be brief. Let me say, first of all, Tim, that I have always been one of the biggest advocates that if you want the advantages of competition, you can't make everything the same. But I would agree with you that it's hard for me to believe that a registrant would make a decision on choosing a registrar based on the this issue. But that's just, I'll leave it at that.
A couple of quick comments. First of all, we are focusing on the bad, we should be focusing on the bad actors, not the largest two registrars in terms of practices. The second thing is, in terms of competition, I think all we're trying to do is restore the situation of a number of years ago where virtually every registrant could renew after expiration. And that disappeared along the way. And we're trying to, in the case, and some of my colleagues are trying to put back that right or guaranteed ability. But some of the other issues we'll be talking about next. The next question is, if we can go on who is. Currently, if a registrant goes, or either they or their friend or whatever, goes and looks at who is after the expiration period, they will be presented with a potentially very confusing situation. Most of the large registries do an auto-renew. Therefore, from the point of view of the registry, the domain is going to expire a year from now. And some, you know, the registrant will say, gee, I don't remember renewing, but I guess it's renewed, and there's no problem. That can be confused even more by the fact that most registration agreements allow the registrar to change the owner name in WHOIS. Some do, some don't. But that can add a certain level of confusion to the issue. So this question essentially says, and it focuses primarily on the renewal date, should it be clear from WHOIS that the domain is not renewed, even if there happens to be an auto-renew grace period that is a registrar-registry relation interaction? Next slide. If there's no questions. Yep.
This is Mikey again. I'll use this as a good example of the kinds of things that I think we can find some middle ground on in terms of consistency. I agree on Tim's point on that.
Just one interruption. That one thing on the WHOIS date was one of the things that we had virtual unanimity registrars and users in terms of fixing that problem.
Never mind.
Alan, I'm having trouble correlating from your report the questions that were asked in the executive summary and the questions on your slides. The first two were the same. Now they're diverting.
We tried to extract a few of the more important and interesting questions, given that we don't have time for all of them, either here or in the session on Thursday. All right. The next question is, the next basic issue area is what happens post-expiration. Now, the comment was made a few minutes ago that people don't react until their domain stops working. There is nothing in the RAA compelling a registrar to do anything specific after expiration. And in fact, the range of what really happens is all over the place. Websites normally stop working and get redirected to a registrar page, often pay-per-click, but that's not the relevant issue. Some of them say clearly that the domain has expired, this is what to do. Some don't say that. Other services, an email is a good example, may or may not continue working. So we end up with a lot of services on the web that may continue working post-expiration and will continue working until either the domain name is deleted or it gets sold or auctioned to someone else. So a registrant may well be in a position that they don't know the domain has expired. If the messages have gotten redirected, there's a large number of domains, for instance, that are used only for email. That email may keep on working to the day they lose it irrecoverably. So this question focuses essentially on what should happen. Work group is generally has a large consensus that everything should stop working. Failure to work is the best indication that it's not, that there's a problem. There's a small number of people who feel that some services should continue to the very last moment when it disappears and is no longer recoverable at all. Next slide. The RGP, the Redemption Grace Period, was envisioned as during when the as the final step of a domain's life, it gets deleted by the registrar. This, of course, was before the aftermarket developed, when various domains can change hands after expiration, that if a domain name is deleted, that it can be recovered through the registry redemption grace period. Currently, all the unsponsored registries except, I think, .pro and .name, I may have those wrong, offer it. So most of the unsponsored GTLDs offer it. The sponsored GTLDs, none of them offer it. And one can presume, since it is not in the contract or requirement, if we let nature take its course, none of the new GTLDs will offer it, or certainly not very many. So the focus of this question is, should the redemption grace period be a mandatory required service from registries and registrars? The registrar issue is, again, since it's not required by the registrar, if a registry that offers the RGP puts the name into the special hold status after it's deleted, because it can only be recovered by the registrar of record, it may be that the registrant cannot get it back anyway, because there's simply no mechanism to request it. So these questions essentially focus on, should the RGP be available regardless? Yes, John?
So I think the question could be reworded and said, should this be a consensus policy, right? That would make it apply to both registries and registrars and new GTLDs as well.
Yes, we were trying in these questions, especially there will be a version of these questions which will be asked in conjunction with the comment period, and we're trying to use as few buzzwords as possible. But
that's
yes,
fine.
Anything within picket fence would likely
right.
be consensus policy. Other things might be in some other form.
And some of you have heard me say this before, obviously, and some of you know that I was involved in the design and implementation of the original RGP. To this day, I've never understood why that wasn't considered a consensus policy, because I don't think there was anybody in the community that had any problem with it. But that said, it's not. And I think I would support the requirement that it be. I put a question mark by that on my notes because maybe I'm missing something there. I do often. But my inclination is yes.
The question was raised, are there any special purpose TLDs for which it's not really applicable? But I think in discussing it, we decided that that could really be handled in a consensus policy.
I think that's accurate. There are a consensus policy can have exception cases, because in some cases it just doesn't apply. But yeah. I think you're right.
One can always have a funnel process to not offer the GTLD instead of the way it is now. That's all we have the presentation is out of order. If we can go on to the next one, please. That's all in the summary of the questions we plan to be looking at. We will be issuing the report in a comment period starting shortly after the Brussels meeting. And along with that, we will be trying to do some level of survey, again, trying to put the questions in a form that someone who has not sat through all the working group meetings can answer them and have some understanding of what the questions are about. That's a little bit of new ground for ICANN comment periods, other than the fact that the board committee looking at public participation is doing something very similar right now. And we will continue, and hopefully we'll come to closure on being able to make some recommendations. I would like to think that we'll be able to make a recommendation to council. It's as was discussed when we were looking at work group composition, it's going to be hard. It's not clear how one develops consensus when a full half of the group is, I won't say against things, but certainly would prefer not to see formal policy enacted. And I'm not quite sure how we're going to go forward on that. James will tell us how, though.
Well, I just want to point out that I don't necessarily see that as a problem, especially when you consider, just looking at the surveys, that the registrars participating in this group have not been a block or have not been unified on all these questions and have, I think, taken some differing positions with one another on the group. So I don't see it as painting all of them with the same color brush and saying that registrars on the group think like this. That hasn't always been the case.
No, certainly, and there's been a lot of interesting discussion. At this point, the poll, if one summarized the question, the last survey we did on should there be consensus policy to make to legislate, as it were, some of these, there is a very marked split between the participants in the working group.
Thank you very much, and thanks to the working group. I know there are certain working groups that have gotten a lot more attention. I personally believe the work of this group is very important and needed, and maybe just because of my history and the issue when it first originated with RGP and so forth, way back when I was working with Louis. And but thanks, I very much appreciate it. Just one last question is. We on Wednesday we will have very short period of time for an update, mainly where you're at, the fact that there's going to be a comment period, and encourage people to comment, and then estimated targets. Doesn't have to be too precise. Now is Marika going to give that? Do you want to give that? Just so we know and we identify the person, so that they're ready to give that few minutes of a status update on Wednesday.
My inclination would be to say Marika should do that one, but
okay, that's fine.
I think between Herbie and Tim, we'll be
sure.
We can accommodate.
Yeah, it'll be a very brief period of time because, like usual, our council meeting is going to run out of time. So thank you. That's very good, and thanks again. And if we can move very quickly then into the. IRTP-B PDP and talk about that.
Hi, it's Michele. Well, I'll talk you through this quickly. Since this audience is so small and looking at its composition, most of you seem to have a fairly good idea of what we're talking about. I'll kind of fly through this. IRTP, inter-registrar transfer policy, basically it's the policy that dictates how domain names are transferred in between registrars. Terribly exciting. I'll skip through the first couple of bits here. Right, the charter questions, I think, is the one we want. Okay. So the charter questions we've been looking at is, should there be a process or special provisions for urgent return of hijacked registration / inappropriate transfers or change of registrant? Then there's the other one we're looking at is registrar lock statuses, whether there should be best practices, clarifications or other changes in relation to the lock statuses. I think that was it. That was the two questions, wasn't it? Yes, it was. Oh, you grouped them into two. I was wondering, I'm thinking, my God, that got really short. so, you know... Yeah, those Tuesday afternoons, you know. The basic thing here was that the SAC and various other groups have done numerous reports and have identified that there are issues with domains being hijacked. What can we do to solve this in some sane fashion so that if, for example, using a silly example, GoDaddy.com or Amazon.com or some other domain which is being used by some large entity or whatever was swiped and the name servers updated or whatever, that they would be able to get the domain back into a functioning state quickly, easily and painlessly. Now the problem we've been working with, there are several little questions that we've been looking at. Let's see, public comment periods we've had a lot of input from the ICANN compliance team, just kind of going through, you know, instead of, one of the problems we have with a lot of the PDPs is that people say there's an issue, but when you ask, push them on it and say, look, can you give us some data to work with, it comes back to the answer, oh, but there's an issue, there's a problem, and you're going to go, okay, can we have something more specific? So ICANN compliance went off and they actually analysed a lot of the complaints that they'd received over I think it was over a 3-month period, and they were able to break down the complaints, and then we were able to look at those and go, right, okay, so this is actually what people are complaining about. Now, obviously, we're bearing in mind the fact that we're only going to see a tip of an iceberg. It's not obviously not going to be every single complaint is actually going to make its way there, but it gives us something to work with, which was very, very helpful. Another couple of things just in terms of process. Due to the sheer volume of documents that generally get published in the run-up to a public meeting such as this one, we decided that we would publish this document, an initial report, but we wouldn't open the public comment period until after the meeting. We did that simply because the public comment periods can only be open for a certain period of time, and if you've got 10 important ones, then you know people just won't have the time, bandwidth, energy, whatever, to do that. We are, of course, we do want the feedback, we do want people to give us input, but we were just thought that for pragmatic reasons, let's do this after this meeting. Let's see if I skip forward another slide. Yes. Preliminary conclusions, draft recommendations. Right. Looking at Charter Question 1. As a group recognises the need for a process for the urgent return of a domain name, which I already spoke about quickly. So this is where we came up with a proposal, which is the expedited transfer reverse policy. And since this is ICANN, we thought we had to give that a nice little acronym. So now you have... please meet our friend ETRP, which will get added to the ICANN glossary. thank you. Perfect. So, yes, we've done that. I don't know if Paul or James would like to say something about how we worked on this.
I can address that, Michele, and that... when we were looking at this issue, we realized that a lot of the major or larger registrars really were already working on this issue in an ad hoc basis, one-on-one with one another. They'd established context, and really almost when you start to expand those bilateral relationships, you had a network of cooperative registrars that that could help address these problems. So what we tried to do, in effect, was document how that process looked and what it would look like in the format of a consensus policy or a policy recommendation, because I'm not as willing right now to fully endorse this as it currently stands. But we tried to kind of encapsulate what that would look like. And hopefully it would be something that we could put out there that registrars that we'd never encountered before would also help... work through these issues, we would have something to fall back on. In my personal opinion, a lot has been bolted onto this ETRP proposal since that time, and now I think it's still very much an open question.
I mean, the key thing is that we're trying to find a solution to a problem, but the big issue is how can we solve one problem without creating a whole series of cascade of side issues. So one of the areas that we know people have issues with would be people involved with any form of aftermarket activity, for example. This could cause an issue for them. The basic premise we started on was, okay, a domain has been hijacked, stolen, whatever term you wish to use. How do we get it back to its rightful registrant, person or entity that's in charge, responsible, using that domain? I'm trying to avoid using words like owner. That was what we were trying to solve. Now, of course, the thing is, the issue, as James alludes to, is that there's 900 odd registrars. Some of them are very, very, very small. Some of them do not answer emails. They do not pick up the phone when you ring them. Neither the other registrars, registry operators, or ICANN staff have accurate and up-to-date contact information to be able to access those people in a hurry at times. So this is part of where this came from.
Yeah, to that point, the hijackers know exactly who the individual registrars are and through social networks know when they go on vacation, and they use that very much to their advantage. So we're really looking for something that if you've never met someone before or you couldn't get them or they were, you know, non-contactable, that we could still execute this policy. So that was part of the...
I mean, that was the idea. Now, it is what we've come up with. Started off with something quite simple. Lots of other things got added into it. It's far from perfect, which is, of course, where we want feedback from the community to see how it can be tweaked, changed, modified, whatever, so that it actually does what we originally intended.
Michaela, am I correct that you have a new working group member because of this particular issue?
That
am
would
I
be
identifying
correct.
The correct one?
At least one.
Okay. And I'm glad that, you know, if there's impact to them, that that's covered. But it seems to me if in fact there was fraudulent activity that somebody lost their domain as a result of, that getting it back as quickly as possible. And I understand all the, I think I have a pretty good feel for all the complications in that, is really important. One reason is that, you know, the more time goes by, the more other changes can happen. It can be even more complicated. So I appreciate the fact that registrars have devoted a lot of time to this particular effort because you're directly impacted and have the best view of it. So thanks for that. But boy, the general goal here, I think, is clear, and I'm glad you're looking at the details because that's where it really is important to do.
Thanks. I mean, the thing from, as we say, is we want people to give us the feedback. We don't want it to have a negative impact on other things, but at the same time, just because it could have a negative impact, a consequence in one area, doesn't mean that you can't find some kind of solution. Mikey, go ahead.
I didn't mean to cut you off, McKaylee. This is Mikey. Tim, you want to go? The only thing I wanted to chime in on was I wanted to make it clear, Chuck, that it's not just registrars that are involved in this and interested in this. That, you know, there's pretty strong participation from, you know, the non-contracted parties too, and, you know, for the very reasons that you stated, and to amplify what Michaela's saying, what we're finding is that if we're not very careful about describing the edges of this, you know, what's in this thing and what's outside of it, pretty soon you get all these unintended consequences, and that's where we're really wrestling with the details right now.
Just a question, I guess. So as far as, you know, we're talking about urgent return, so what the working group is suggesting is that the best way to handle that is the way many registrars are doing today, that's between themselves, and that this particular process may not be as quick or as fast in resolving the problem, but outside of registrar cooperation, it's the next best option to get things resolved as quickly as possible. Is that kind of what...
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's an escalation. So that if, for example, let's say there's a domain... I'll use my company as an example. That way I can't get sued except by myself. Let's say that a domain was transferred from GoDaddy to Black Knight without the registrant's authorization, that somebody hijacked the account or hijacked some other vector and basically was able to do that fraudulently. And then that, you know, GoDaddy could not contact Black Knight, and that there was no way for you to have any dialogue with us in order to get that domain back to the registrant, that this process would be able to kick in so that you acting on behalf of your registrant will be able to get the domain back to them. Mikey and then James.
I think the other thing that needs to be clear is that this, and this gets back to what's in and what's out, this is not a dispute resolution process. The dispute resolution processes already exist. All this particular proposal is talking about the mechanism to quickly return a domain, the premise being urgently return and then thoughtfully resolve the dispute. So then we're separating these two. So it needs to be clear that the dispute resolution will probably take some time because you have two parties that are grouchy with each other, unless one's a criminal, in which case they won't show up. And this isn't about that resolution process. It's just about getting the domain back to the presumed proper place prior to resolving the dispute.
Yeah, I think, Mikey, that's an excellent point. To your earlier question, Tim, I think that the preferred choice, I mean, if I can pick on Paul for just a minute, if there were a transfer issue between GoDaddy and Network Solutions, I think we have a good context there. We can work through some existing relationships. It's in those cases where we are unable to contact the other registrar or they're unreachable that we wanted something a little more urgent. But I think that the first choice would be to reach out to that direct relationship. And Mikey's absolutely correct. I think that what we've recognized is, while this process may not be perfect, any kind of a problem that you have, whether it's a dispute or an issue of control over a registration, gets worse with multiple transfers. If nothing, we can just kind of stop that chain of transfers and keep something from hopping around the world and bring it back to its status quo before the first IRTP, and then start to address some of those other issues. Otherwise, we lose that window, and it runs off down the road.
I mean, there's various other details within the current proposal with as we put together. I mean, I won't go into all the technicalities here. It's in there. The other areas that we also looked at, which was in to do with who is again, both in PEDNR, which Alan was talking about earlier, and in IRTP, one of the areas that we as a group have identified as being problematic is in relation to who is statuses. Okay, sorry, I'm skipping around. Never mind. I've started talking about lock status, so I'll stick with it then. Again, what we were looking at there was just saying that that slide's wrong, so you have to ignore it. This is what happens when I remember. Never mind. It's like similar with the post expiry, that if the who is could reflect the reason for a lock, we had a lot of discussion with various different people about this, including some of your colleagues from VeriSign, who went through and explained to us in great detail about lots of different things. So the baseline of it is EPP is extensible, so if we can extend it, and this will actually help mitigate a lot of the issues. But of course, as I skip forward a slide, which I do apologize for, the who is, thick who is versus thin who is, the basic consensus within the group was that thick who is makes life easy, thin who is causes us headaches. Just to summarize.
State that again, please.
That thick who is easier to deal with when it comes to transfers. Because the thing is this, that the who is format is standardized. One of the things that, as a registrar, we run our own backend. We're not as big as some of the other registrars, but one of the problems we've run into constantly is with 900 odd registrars, there's probably 600 who is formats. So when you're actually trying to parse the who is programmatically so that you can actually get the data you need in order to get it authorized, that it causes problems.
That's assuming their who is system is operational and responsive. Then you can parse the data that comes back.
And this was the other part of it.
And what was the second? What confused me is I got the first part with regard to thick who is. What's the second thing you said with regard to?
Well, the thin who is causes problems for us because the format isn't always uniform. Plus, if, as James says, you're working on the basis that the who is server is going to respond. So, for example, I could be submitting a request for a client to transfer a domain from Registrar X to ourselves, and that could be held up for several days or weeks, because every time we try to poll their Whois server to get the data we need, it doesn't respond.
We're running out of time. So a quick question, and this is coming from me as a VeriSign person. For many years, registrars really didn't even want to consider us being a thick registry. Has that position changed then in the registrar community?
I don't think I can answer for the registrar community. I can only answer for myself.
You can respond to me separately, but it'd be very helpful information for us, because since registrars are our customers, we've always tried to be very sensitive to that. But if that position has changed, and we don't probably have too much time to talk about it now. Go ahead.
Just briefly, I mean, just commenting on the very narrow issue of transfers, and I know that there are other issues involved with the thick, thin Whois, but we were just identifying the operational challenge of a thin registry with transfers.
Okay.
That's all.
Thanks.
I mean, operationally, that was the thing that we all agreed on.
Just something that crossed my mind when I was reading the second part of that slide, where it says registrant can affect a change of control. As you look at that, the only and I don't know how far you plan to get into that part of it. From what I recall, not far, but that there's two parties to a registration agreement, and so you know it takes both parties to actually affect that change of control. I don't know if that has any effect on any of the policies you're looking at, but you know, the registrant can't change control without cooperation of the registrar. Takes both parties to that agreement. So I don't know where you were going with that, if anywhere. But
I think this was to do with more to do with clarifying the IRTP policy with regard to registrant and administrative contract. I think that's where that comment came from. Yes, it's only the registrant can affect a change of control while both the registrant and admin contact remain eligible to authorize a transfer. So I think there was some discussion about which one of the two had the power, and I think that's where that came in from. Rudika might remember.
Yeah. It doesn't deal with the question. I mean, of course, a registrar will be involved. This basically deals with the question between registrant and admin contact, and I think there the suggestion in the working group was that maybe it should only be the registrant that can actually affect a change while both of them are still eligible to authorize the transfer itself. So I think it was related to that, and maybe we should clarify that on the slide.
Maybe. Sorry. There are several other areas within this PDP that we do need to look into more deeply, obviously. Sorry, my throat's really gone. But we actually have spent quite a lot of our time focusing on the rapid return, because that was, I think, possibly because a lot of us agreed that it was an issue that needed to be dealt with. But obviously, there's other questions that need to be covered. The registrar lock status, also is a reference there as well, that if there is a review of the UDRP at some point in the future, then that might be a time also to look at the lock statuses there. There's a couple of other bits and pieces, but
how big has that problem reduced at all over time in recent months, years, as far as the lock issue? Are most registrars that, to your knowledge, you know, is it there's easy procedures for removing lock by registrants?
This is an area which is a little bit contentious. One of the things that we were looking at, and there was quite a bit of discussion here, was it's on that slide. It's in relation to removing the lock. If the registrar does not provide a means to allow a registered name holder to remove the lock status themselves, then registrar must facilitate removing the lock within 5 calendar days of receiving a request from the registered name holder. I mean, basically, we propose new language for that section of the IRTP. The bit there on that slide is our suggested language. The part of the part of the discussion kind of centered around, you know, whether it was calendar days versus working days, which some people found amusing, but ultimately it was quite pertinent to it. But the lock status issue, some people are not particularly happy with how this is communicated to registrants. So I think there's going to be some more discussion on that. Hopefully, we'll be able to get some constructive input from some of the newer members of the working group. And of course, we would welcome feedback from everybody who wants to give feedback when we open the comment period. I think that about covers it. Does anybody have any questions? No? Okay.
Okay, that's it. Thank you. Again, you know, and let me say something different about this particular group. One of the things I've really been pleased with is the continuity of the people who are willing to continue to work on this. Some of us, there may not be too many of us left, but that went through the many years where we struggled with even developing the first consensus policy with regard to registrar transfers. And we finally achieved something, and we're way past the time when it needs to be reviewed. And I do support the breaking it down into smaller subsets like we did. And this is one of those unique areas where it really requires people who deal with it every day to work on. So, again, a lot of that burden falls on registrars, and not that it's not important to other people in the community and not that they're not involved, but I appreciate the ongoing commitment of all of you on this working team. Let's see, we're on B. I think we go to D. Do we go to D or E? E, we go to E. So we got a ways to go, but I hope that you can continue we can plug away and eventually complete our full review of this process. Thanks very, very much for your commitment to that. I appreciate it a lot. And I think that's it. I've got to go get ready for a meeting with the GAC. And by the way, for those who want to attend that, it's in room 400.